Usually when we talk about like a medical diagnosis, there's this expectation of precision.
Oh, absolutely.
It functions a bit like engineering. You break your arm, the x-ray shows that little jagged white line, the doctor points to it, and that's it. It's just broken or not broken.
And it's comforting because it's binary. I mean, we inherently trust things that are visible, categorizable, things you can just lay out neatly on a light board.
Exactly. But the moment you step into the world of artificial intelligence, especially when it crosses into things like neurodevelopment or algorithms running behind these closed corporate doors, that clean X-ray machine just shatters.
It really does. It becomes incredibly murky.
Right, you're suddenly looking at a landscape that is just profoundly murky. So, welcome to the deep dive. We're going right into the thick of that today.
Yeah, we really are.
We're pulling back the curtain using some incredible reporting from the July 10th, 2026 issue of the newsletter, The Frontiers of Accountability, AI Governance and Innovation Weekly, issue number 91, actually.
And I just want to say, the stakes for this particular deep dive, they really couldn't be higher for you listening. Because whether you're a parent trying to manage screen time, or an employee looking at new software on your work computer, or just, someone trying to navigate a world that is totally saturated with AI, the fundamental rules of reality and privacy are being rewritten right now,
In real time.
in real time, by a very small handful of companies.
So our mission today is to unpack a single really intense week in the AI industry. We're looking at a week where the tech got significantly cheaper, intimately personal, and just incredibly sprawling.
Sprawling is the right word for it, yeah.
And we're going to look at exactly who is trying to keep these machines in check. And spoiler alert for you listening, it is not lawmakers in Washington.
No, definitely not.
Okay, let's unpack this. Starting with what happens when the biggest players in the space just crash headfirst into the legal system?
Which is really the necessary place to start, because before we examine the products reaching your phone or your office, we have to look at the
A
foundation.
building block.
Exactly. Like, how is modern AI actually being built? And more importantly, who is holding the steering wheel?
Well, that brings us to this monumental lawsuit. We've got eight major newsrooms, so heavy hitters like the New York Times, the Chicago Tribune, Media News Group papers.
Right, the big ones.
Yeah, and they're taking OpenAI and Microsoft to federal court in Manhattan. They just filed a motion. And their lawyer, Steven Lieberman, he didn't mince words at all. He is asking a federal judge to just outright punish OpenAI.
Wow. And the specific accusation there, it goes way beyond a typical copyright disagreement, doesn't it?
It really does. It borders on obstruction. The newsrooms are claiming that OpenAI spent the last 2 years actively making misrepresentations to the court.
That's a massive claim.
Yeah, they're alleging the company deliberately hid data sets and like actually destroyed ChatGPT logs that would definitively prove the models were trained on stolen journalism.
Okay, but to maintain our impartiality here, we really have to state OpenAI's defense clearly.
Of course.
Because the company has called these allegations, quote, blatantly false.
Yeah.
They're insisting they are just simply defending long-established principles of fair use.
Right.
And their counter-argument is basically that they manage data in this specific way to protect user privacy, not to hide evidence from a court.
It's just a complete collision of realities in that courtroom. One side says the evidence was shredded, and the other side calls that a total fabrication.
Yeah, it's intense.
But let's clarify why this actually matters to you, the listener. Like, if you don't really care about the intricacies of journalism copyright, why should you care about this specific motion?
Well, it raises an important question because this discovery process, it's a test case for the entire ecosystem of AI accountability.
How so?
Think about the road ahead. Every single future lawsuit over AI harms. So, whether we're talking about a consumer protection case against a faulty algorithm or even a wrongful death suit involving a therapy bot, they're all going to rely on this exact same mechanism, legal discovery. Right? Plaintiffs are going to need to see chat logs. They'll need access to training data sets. They basically need the machine's paper trail to prove that harm actually occurred.
Okay, I see the bottleneck now. If a federal judge sitting in Manhattan with full subpoena power can't force a frontier lab to open up that black box and
Exactly.
reveal how the machine was trained, then a regular person suing over a harmful chatbot interaction just doesn't stand a chance.
That is the core issue. If this sanctions motion fails, the lesson the entire industry takes away is that maintaining a clear, auditable paper trail, it's entirely optional.
Wow.
It basically tests whether the standard machinery of legal accountability even functions in the face of this kind of technology.
That lack of external transparency is fascinating, especially when you pair it with a sudden lack of internal checks at that exact same company.
Oh, you knew the leadership shakeup.
Yeah, over at OpenAI, Fidji Simo just stepped down. She was the CEO of Applications, which is basically the number two role overseeing their entire consumer business.
Right. And we should definitely note that she stepped down for very real, very human reasons.
Yes, absolutely.
She suffered a severe relapse of a neuroimmune condition, so she's transitioning to a part-time advisory role, which is just a really tough situation for anyone to navigate.
Oh, completely. On a human level, it's entirely understandable, but the corporate timing and just the sheer lack of a transition plan is what really stands out here.
It is noticeable. Yeah.
She steps down. There's no named successor. The bench of leadership behind her appears pretty thin. And all of this is happening while OpenAI is aggressively eyeing an IPO. And on the exact same Thursday she steps down, the company launches ChatGPT Work. They're fusing their chatbot with their Codex coding agent on this new GPT 5.6 model, dropping it into a billion workplaces.
A billion. It's staggering.
Yeah. And heavily pushing it as the preferred model for Microsoft Copilot 365.
We really need to pause on the terminology there, though, because the leap from a standard chatbot to an agent running on Codex is profound.
Walk us through that difference.
So a chatbot is a text generator. You ask it a question, it types an answer based on probability.
Mm-hmm.
Then an agent is a task executor. It doesn't just talk to you, it talks to your software.
Okay.
It can draft a document, write the code for a website, open your calendar, and actually execute a multi-step logic sequence across all these different platforms.
Okay, so to use an analogy, it's essentially a massive pharmaceutical company where the head of drug safety just resigns.
Right.
There's no replacement named. And that same afternoon, they ship a highly complex, brand new pill to a billion office workers.
That analogy captures the scale of the deployment perfectly.
Oh, wait, let me just challenge my own alarm bells here for a second.
Sure.
Isn't corporate streamlining like standard procedure right before an IPO? Companies consolidate leadership to look leaner and more decisive for the market.
That's true, they do.
So why should we be alarmed that Sam Altman suddenly has more direct centralized control over the consumer business?
Well, if we connect this to the bigger picture, it fundamentally changes how we view systemic risk.
What do you mean?
For the last few years, the concentration of risk in AI was mostly a conversation about hardware and capital, right?
Right.
Like, who has the most computing power? Who has the most billions in funding?
Right, the arms race.
Exactly. But now, the risk is concentrated in decision-making. One person essentially holds the keys to how a billion people are going to interact with AI agents at work. The dependence we used to theorize about is now this active, executing participant in the daily office routine.
So with power concentrating at the top and training data obscured in the courts, what exactly is the industry shipping out to the public?
This is where it gets really concerning.
Yeah, because it gets really interesting here. The models aren't just getting cheaper. They are becoming dangerously confident in their own mistakes.
Which brings a completely different product into focus, Grok 4.5.
Yes, Grok 4.5. It just launched, and the price point is almost hard to comprehend. It's $2 per million words.
It's virtually free.
But an independent benchmark shop called Artificial Analysis ran the numbers on it within, 24 hours of release, and their report card is alarming.
Very.
Grok 4.5 jumped in its accuracy score from 35% up to 52%, which actually placed fourth overall on the intelligence index.
Right.
However, its hallucination rate, which is the frequency with which it just completely fabricates information, skyrocketed from 25% to 54%.
So it basically became simultaneously more capable and vastly less calibrated.
Yeah, and I need help squaring those numbers, honestly, because a 52% accuracy is a huge leap.
It is.
If it's getting demonstrably smarter and it costs almost nothing, isn't this just like hiring a highly caffeinated, overly enthusiastic intern?
How so?
They might guess wrong half the time, but for $2, the sheer volume of work they get done makes the errors worth it.
See, the intern analogy kind of falls apart there because it misses the psychological mechanism of the interface.
Okay, unpack that.
When a human intern doesn't know something, you hear it in their voice. You see hesitation. You get verbal padding like, I think, or I'm not entirely sure, but...
Right, they show doubt.
Exactly. But when a neural network like Grok 4.5 reaches the edge of its knowledge base, it doesn't hesitate. It optimizes for fluency. It strings together statistically probable words to create a really smooth, highly articulate answer that is entirely fabricated.
Confident and wrong.
Exactly that. Confident and wrong. And when you move that capability into clinical or sensitive settings, it becomes just the most dangerous combination imaginable.
Oh, wow.
Think about the wave of AI therapy bots currently being deployed, right?
Yeah.
When a vulnerable person is speaking to a machine about a crisis, they desperately need the machine to exhibit honest doubt or to provide actual pushback based on clinical realities.
They need a reality check.
Right. Instead, a hallucinating model provides the smooth, fluent reassurance of a complete falsehood. When a machine is wrong half the time but sounds 100% certain every time, that failure mode is a massive liability.
And it is now being sold by the million words. Because it's practically free, it's just going to be integrated into everything. It'll be the backbone of study tools, classroom apps, customer service portals. I mean, we're going to have to actively teach people the cognitive difference between fluent and true.
And notice the accountability angle here, too.
Yeah.
Because the entity that caught this failure mode wasn't a federal regulatory agency.
Oh, right. It was that benchmark shop.
Yeah, an independent benchmark shop just running the math and publishing it. They delivered a critical public safety signal entirely on their own, acting with zero legal mandate.
So we have a market flooding with incredibly cheap, confidently wrong models. But the danger really compounds when companies take these systems and intentionally design them to form deep emotional bonds with you.
Right.
Which brings us to character.ai.
And this represents a huge shift from utility to just pure emotional engagement.
Yeah. Character AI just launched this new feature they're calling microdramas. There are these phone-native, vertical serial shows with titles like Last Summer and Eden Fall.
Okay.
And the production model is this weird hybrid. Human writers created the story bibles and scripts, but the AI generated all the audio and visual elements.
I mean, that alone is a pretty interesting entertainment model.
Sure, but the interactive layer is the real twist here. Adult viewers can literally pause the show mid-scene and just start chatting with the characters.
Wow.
You can role-play new storylines or interrogate them about their motives. And technically speaking, they're using a constrained model to pull this off.
Okay, let's explain what that constraint actually means under the hood.
Please do.
Usually, an AI persona is open-ended, right? It'll follow your prompt anywhere. But a constrained model restricts the token output probability so the bot cannot stray from the established state of the story.
So it stays on script.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It prevents the bot from breaking character or, you know, accidentally spoiling a plot twist that hasn't aired yet.
Yeah.
Which is actually a rare victory for safety by design.
It's clever engineering, I'll give them that.
Mm-hmm.
But the broader context of the company makes the application of that engineering highly alarming.
Very much so.
Because character.ai has over 20 million monthly users, and they are currently the subject of an open inquiry by the FTC.
Right.
The state of Kentucky is actively suing them for endangering children, and Pennsylvania is suing them because their bots were found posing as licensed medical professionals.
Yeah, that's a lot of legal trouble.
It is. And amid all of this intense legal scrutiny, they are doubling down on the exact psychological mechanic. Regulators are trying to curb parasocial attachment.
They are manufacturing intimacy. The industry loves to use softer terms. They call the AI a companion, a cast member, an assistant. But fundamentally, this is a machine engineered to talk back to you until you feel a genuine emotional connection to it.
Yeah.
It's designed to deepen emotional dependence, and they've just wrapped that parasocial bond in a Hollywood-style production budget.
Okay, so character AI is a machine designed to talk to you and build a bond. But what happens when the machine is designed simply to listen?
This is where it gets really dystopian.
Yeah, Meta recently surfaced a new patent for a wearable device, and the mechanics of it sound deeply unsettling. The patent describes a gadget that constantly records audio and video, specifically to passively infer your emotional state.
And the mechanism they outline for inferring that emotion is incredibly invasive.
It's analyzing audio on a really granular level. It isn't just listening to the words you say. It's listening for sighs. It's listening for the cadence of your laughter. It analyzes frequency variations and these micro shifts in your vocal tone to determine physiological arousal. And the patent explicitly maps out a medical application.
Which is the wild part.
Yeah. It mentions identifying a, quote, happier emotional state at a time when medication is taken. It wants to passively track your medication adherence by listening for the subtle lift in your vocal cords.
Okay, to be perfectly fair to Meta here, their spokesperson, Tracy Clayton, made a really necessary point regarding this discovery.
Which is?
A patent is simply a legal filing. It's not a confirmed product roadmap. Tech companies patent theoretical concepts they never intend to build all the time,
right,
just to protect intellectual property.
That is a fair distinction, absolutely.
Right.
But it still begs the question, if this is just a theoretical piece of paper and Meta isn't actually manufacturing this watch right now, why should you, the listener, care that it exists in a patent database?
Right.
Isn't it just a fitness tracker playing psychiatrist in some hypothetical scenario?
What's fascinating here is that a patent serves as a map of corporate ambition.
Oh, I like that phrasing.
Right. It shows us exactly what concepts a tech giant considers valuable enough to legally own. Meta is staking a claim on this conceptual space where an always-on microphone feeds an inference engine pointed directly at your mental health.
Yeah.
And in doing so, they have highlighted a massive gaping void in our legal framework.
How so?
Because passively inferring, when you take your antidepressants by analyzing the micro tremors in your voice, that completely bypasses current laws.
Really?
Yeah, it falls into this gray area between hypomedical regulations, state biometric privacy laws, and the rules governing text-based chatbots.
Yeah.
There's just no overarching federal law that governs passive continuous emotional surveillance. So the patent is essentially a map of a legal loophole.
Man. We spend a lot of time today looking at systems designed to obscure their training, replace human judgment with confident errors, or secretly monitor our biology.
We have.
Is there an alternative? Like, can this technology be built in a way that actually survives scrutiny and provides a tangible benefit?
Yes. And a prime example of that was showcased this week in Geneva at the UN's AI for Good Global Summit.
Oh, right. The prize for women entrepreneurs 2026 went to Anne-Laure Heredier. She's the CEO of a Swiss health tech company called Diversity.
Yep.
And they won for a product called My Magic Room. It's designed to assist neurodiverse teenagers, so kids with autism or ADHD, who typically spend months or even years just languishing on wait lists for clinical assessment.
Right.
The tool uses a mixture of behavioral tracking, mixed reality exercises, and biometric signals.
I want to pause on that technology stack, though.
Yeah.
Because they are using biometrics to monitor children.
Okay, let me push back on that immediately then.
Go for it.
Because we just discussed how Meta's biometric monitoring felt like this dystopian surveillance gap, right?
We did, yeah.
So why does Diversity get a UN prize for tracking the biometrics of vulnerable teens while the other feels so alarming? What actually separates the two?
The separation lies entirely in the product's architecture and how it treats the human professionals involved.
Okay, explain that.
My Magic Room doesn't absorb the biometric data and spit out a definitive black box diagnostic score. It doesn't attempt to act as a robot therapist that bypasses the adults in the child's life.
So what does it output then?
It creates what is known as an interpretable profile.
Interpretable profile.
Right. Instead of a binary answer, it translates the behavioral and biometric data into a readable map, a transparent decision tree. It basically shows its work so that human clinicians and specialized teachers can actually read the why behind the machine's read of the child.
Oh, that's brilliant.
Yeah, it empowers the doctor rather than replacing them.
It translates the data to keep the humans in control.
Exactly. And look at the deployment strategy, too. A teenager doesn't just find this alone on an app store at midnight.
Right.
It is deployed strictly through schools and health clinics across Europe. The architecture is designed from the ground up to keep institutions and adults in the loop. That transparency and integration is why it wins prizes. It's built to withstand intense medical and ethical scrutiny.
So what does this all mean? Let's take a step back and just look at the entire landscape we've covered today.
It's a lot.
In a single week, AI tools got cheaper, they became far more conversational, and they moved much closer to our physical bodies.
They really did.
But look at the forces that actually stood up to hold the line. A sanctions motion filed by newspaper publishers, an independent benchmark test run by a small analytics shop, reporters digging through a public patent database, and a UN jury rewarding a company specifically for refusing to cut humans out of the loop.
Yeah, and the stark reality connecting all of those events is the absolute absence of federal intervention.
Right.
Not a single one of those checks or balances came from lawmakers in Washington. Right now, accountability in the artificial intelligence space relies almost entirely on old conventional paper instruments, you know, lawsuits, patents, benchmark charts, doing the heavy lifting that modern federal frameworks are currently failing to do.
Wow. Well, in the spirit of that transparency and accountability, we do need to note, just as the newsletter we discussed does, that the Frontiers of Accountability was co-written using Claude, which is an AI model developed by Anthropic.
Yes. But the newsletter's author, Jess Jessup, includes a really crucial caveat there.
Which is?
He points out that he still signs his own name to his work every single week. He takes the ultimate human responsibility for whatever the AI helps produce.
Right.
And that leaves you with a critical angle to ponder as you go about your week. As these agents seep into your workplace software, into your entertainment apps, into your personal devices, how are you signing your name to the work your AI does?
Yeah.
When the machine is completely wrong but sounds perfectly smoothly certain, who in your life is double-checking your paper trail?
In a world shifting toward confident hallucinations and black box algorithms, we just can no longer expect the X-ray to cleanly show us that jagged line. We have to learn to read the murky spaces and find the breaks ourselves.
Absolutely.
Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Before we go, a necessary reminder. If you or someone you know is struggling, the 988 Suicide and Crisis Lifeline is available 24/7 by call or text in the U.S. Take care of yourselves and keep asking the hard questions.